Good morning. Today's daf in Ksuvos Yud Ches, when Yud Zayin Amud Beis, we're starting at the first wide line, V'lesnei. The Gemara's discussion is going to be primarily today, something that the Gemara started yesterday. We just started the discussion yesterday, and it's going to take us through most of today's daf up until the Mishnah. And what is that discussion? That discussion revolves around the Shita of Rav Yehoshua. Rav Yehoshua's Moda. So he's going to concede. Now, Rav Yehoshua has consistently throughout the first parak said that we're not going to believe her. And despite the fact that she has an argument, and even she has a claim, and even if that claim is a good claim, and when I call it a good claim, meaning let's even say it has a migu. Migu is a general principle throughout Shas in which you have a claim, but behind it you have even a better claim that you could have made, and you forfeited the better claim that you could have made, and you made the inferior claim. So that gives you an enhanced claim. It basically says to you, look, I could have said better, I didn't say better, so therefore it enhances your credibility. Okay, so this is the principle of Migu that's discussed throughout Chas, and our sugyo is going to be one of the principle, the primary sugyos that discuss this very topic. So Rav Yehoshua says, here's where I'm going to concede. In the case of the Mishnah, this is the opening Mishnah of the second parak, which we did yesterday, 2 days ago, really. The opening Mishnah described the following scenario, having nothing to do with marriage, but again, we're really focusing on Taina, on claims, and claims that are built on a Migu. So let's say, for example, a man says to another, this property that I'm on right now was owned by your father, and your father sold it to me. So in other words, this kid did not know the history of the property, and so I'm telling him now two things. One, property was not mine. It wasn't originally mine. It originally belonged to your father. But then, number two, he sold it to me. So in other words, I put myself in the weak position, but because I did that, so therefore I can extricate myself from that position. This, in principle, is what's called a pesha asur or pesha yitur, which seems to be a very close relative to that of migu. In fact, some are of the opinion that basically it's the same, it's the very same idea. In other words, the pesha asur pesha yitur is really identical to migu. Okay, that is that's an advanced level discussion, which we're not going to have, not because we can't have it, but simply because our goal is to finish the daf. So anyway, that's the basic idea. Rav Yehoshua says, I'm going to give you that case, meaning I'm going to agree to that case. In contradistinction to what? So that we discussed at length 2 days ago, meaning in the first daf here, the second perek. So the Gemara says, what was he contrasting it to? Now, the simple pshat, of course, is that he was contrasting it to the case immediately preceding it in the Mishnah. But as the Gemara pointed out, really it could be and probably is going back on an earlier case. So what was the earlier case? The earlier case that we discussed back in the first perek is the following. Man and woman, after the discovery that she wasn't a basula, meaning after the marriage, after the first night, she was not a basula. And so now, claim, counterclaim. So she says, Misha Arstani Nanasti. So her claim was, look, okay, now I'll confess, meaning I'll come clean. I wasn't a basula, but I was violated during Kiddushin. Okay, and now, unfortunate for me and unfortunate for you. Obviously unfortunate for me, but unfortunate for you in that, in other words, I'm not going to lose any money as a result of it. In other words, I was already married to you at the time, and so therefore, I'm not losing money, and my ksuva is going to be for $200. And his counter-argument is no. In other words, you were not nanas, you weren't violated. It was a willing act. Now, of course, it wasn't during Kiddushin, because then he would be saying that she's an Eishes Ish, and that would make her usher to him. But he says to her that, look, you were with a man before Kiddushin, you didn't let me know, and therefore you're not entitled to $200. Now, what at that point in time, is she entitled to $100, is she entitled to zero? So that's a major debate that we saw in the first parak, which we're not going to go over again right now. But anyway, but her claim is a migu claim. Why is it a migu claim? Because she didn't make the best argument she could have made. What argument did she make? What claim did she make? Misha Astani Nanasti. I was violated. So what's a better claim she could have made? Mukas Eitz. Why is Mukad Eitz a better claim? Because with the claim of Mukad Eitz, she doesn't prohibit herself to Kohanim. Right? Misha Astani Nanasti, she was with another man, that's going to prohibit her to other Kohanim. Even though, right, just if we can remember that which we've learned a number of times, and it's a little bit painful to remember, but it's true. And that is that when a woman's with another man, even if it's through Onei, she can't be with a Kohen. In other words, that'll prohibit her to a Kohen. So her claim of Misha Astani Nanasti is going to prohibit her to Kohanim, meaning future Kohanim. Granted, right now she's currently married, but still, in other words, that's going to create Isser for her. As opposed to the claim of Mukad Eitz, where the dollar figure is going to be the same, but it's not going to make her prohibited to Kohanim in the future. So that is a case of Migul where Rabbi Yeshua is not conceding. I don't concede that case of Migul. I do concede the case of Migul in our Mishnah. So that is the starting point of our discussion, meaning just to know where we are in today's daf, you have to remember that. And, oh, by the way, one other important detail that we have to remind ourselves of, what's the difference? Meaning, if Rabbi Yeshua is going to agree to the concept of Migul, and Rabbi Yeshua concedes in our Mishnah's case, where he says, the land belonged to your father, and I purchased it from him, so why is that a case of Migul where Rabbi Yeshua is like, I'm fine with that Migul, but in the case of the husband and wife, where she says Meshar Stani Nanasti, and that claim comes with an amigu, how come he's not conceding over there? So the Gemara had a line which we're supposed to remember, which is in one case Shor Shachal Afanecha, and the other case in Shor Shachal Afanecha. So let's just go over that. A really important point, and that is that in the case of the husband and wife Shor Shachal Afanecha, it's an expression. It means the animal shechted in front of us. What does the expression mean? Right now, the circumstance demands an explanation, meaning she was discovered not to be a basula. Okay, we have a problem. And now she's coming to explain it. Well, in other words, this is intuitive, by the way. Everyone here understands that if something went wrong and now it demands an explanation, well, that explanation can easily be understood as a rationalization, justification. In other words, it may not be perfectly honest and truthful. The fact that the circumstance demands an explanation is really going to impair the claim that she makes. On the other hand, in the case where this property was owned by your father and I purchased from him, the circumstances didn't demand an explanation. Right now, I'm comfortably sitting on this property. Everyone thinks it belongs to me, and now I'm telling people that, yeah, but let me give you a history lesson. So the circumstance didn't demand an explanation. And you went on to say, first of all, the land was not originally owned by me, but I purchased it from your father. So there, with the migul, coupled with the fact that it's not Shor Shachal Afanecha, the circumstance didn't demand an explanation. So as a result of that, it enhances your claim. Good. That is all but what we have been covering now. That's a pretty good synopsis and a quick review. 7.5 minutes. Let's go with today's daf.
Rabbi, can I ask one quick question? What's the fundamental difference between an almana being allowed to marry a kohen and a divorce? Like, fundamentally, they both have been women that have...
Yeah, correct. Men. Correct. Later I'll share with you. Please come to me later. The Sefer Chinuch tries to give an explanation, meaning it's right now the best thing I could say, which is the most correct thing I could say, is that that's what the Torah says, meaning the Torah itself doesn't give a reason why. And so we're left to guessing, but the Sefer Chinuch does provide some explanation. I'll share with you later. But it's an attempt to explain it. In other words, and by the way, the Gemara never explains, meaning the Gemara itself never gives a reason. Gemara just simply understands that that's just simply the case. Okay. Velisnei b'didei. So, what we're going to be going through for most of today's daf is of the case that the Mishnah gave, in which we know that Rabbi Yeshua is going to concede, meaning it's going to be successful migu. So, the Mishnah gave a case, and what the Gemara wants to know is, why did the Mishnah give a simpler case and a more straightforward case? Meaning, what's the case in our Mishnah where a man says to another, this property was owned by your father and I bought it from him? Why couldn't the Mishnah have given other cases? That's basically the subject matter of today's daf. And what we're going to learn is why would any other case be not be a good case study for our Mishnah? So we already went over one yesterday, Velisnei. So we are now up to two. I think there's going to be a total of four in total. Yeah. I counted. So there's going to be four in total. So we are on Tezayin Amud Beis and the first wide line.
Yud
Zayin Amud Beis. I said Tezayin? Okay, good. I stand corrected. So good. So Yud Zayin Amud Beis and the first wide line. V'lisnei b'didei v'lukma kagon. So the Gemara says, so let's do the following. Let's say that the claim and counterclaim is direct. B'didei, meaning it's not that I bought it from your father, but rather I bought it from you. So So the Gemara says like this. Why doesn't the case amount to the following? I've been living on this property now for 3 years, okay? And I purchased it from you. And I've been on this land now for 3 years. Now, if it's 3 years, and it was 3 years that went unchallenged, so what have we learned already? That's what's called having a chazak on the property, and you are now the rightful owner of the property. And again, we discussed this yesterday, but just quickly to review again. So why 3 years going unchallenged? Why does that make the property yours? Because there is terms in terms of how long you're expected to hold on to the title. So you're not expected to hold on to the title for more than 3 years. So for the first 3 years after you purchase it, so you know that you're going to be challenged in terms of are you the rightful owner? So you're holding on to the title. But for 3 years that come and go, and those 3 years are unchallenged, at that point in time, you're not expected to hold the paperwork anymore. So in other words, at that point in time, you are the assumed purchaser of the property, and you don't need documentation to prove, in fact, that you're the owner of the property. This is what we learned yesterday. This is the third parak of Baba Basra, which parenthetically, by the way, is a really long parak over there, but discussing this very issue. So the 3 years have to be unchallenged. Now, let's say my claim is the following. I've been on the land for 3 years, and of those 3 years, two of those years were quote-unquote clean years. Clean years meaning you could have challenged me, you should have challenged me, you didn't. But that third year, it's questionable whether it's an unchallenged year. Meaning, I went for that third year going unchallenged, but I'm going to acknowledge the fact that you did have to run away. So on the run, it's hard to make a challenge when you're currently on the run. Why was he on the run? So that's an important detail. Ukagon shebarach, barach machmas mai. So why was he running during that third year? So the Gemara says, look, if he was on the run because he was running for his life, okay, what are the details? I don't know. Doesn't matter. In any event, he had to run because somebody was after him to take his life. So at that point in time, so he is now going to be excused for not challenging in that third year, meaning that's a legitimate excuse. Therefore, that third year, it does not count towards the Shnei Chazakah, towards the years of Chazaka. So the Gemara says, so obviously over there, the claim is not a fair claim. It's not a legitimate claim. Okay, good. So, Iva Ida Baruch Machmas Mamani by Lelim Chuye. And the Gemara says, then what? He's running away because of creditors? So the Gemara says, that's not a good excuse. Meaning, people run away because of creditors. Okay, it happens. Fine. But that's not going to give him a good excuse in terms of why he didn't lodge a complaint during the third year. In other words, the formal protest, the official protest that you have to put in when somebody's squatting on your property. So it doesn't have to be in front of the squatter. It could be done away from him. How do I know that? Did not. And all the Gemara now is going to do for the next 5-6 lines is just simply establish that this is in fact so. The machal does not have to be done in front of him. How do I know that? Because we're going to learn together. First, we'll learn a Mishnah in Baba Basra in the third parak. Ashal Sharatz is the Chazaka Yehuda Ve'Ever Yadim Va'Galo. We're dividing Eretz Yisrael into three parts, right? North, south, and east. And Hayah Be'Yehuda Ve'Ichzik Be'Galo Be'Galo Ve'Ichzik Be'Yehuda Ina Chazaka Che'Imo Be'Medina. In other words, Chazaka is only going to count when you and the original owner are in the same province together, whether you're in the north, the south, or the east. But if you're in the north and he's in the south, so therefore your squatting doesn't count. Why? Because he can't protest. Why? Because he's not in front of you. Now, v'havinamba, on that Mishnah, my kasavar, the Gemara says, I don't understand. E kasavar machashal b'fanav havi amecha afilo b'yehuda v'gala nami. If a challenge does not have to be made formally in front of the squatter, so then make it wherever you are. And if a protest that you make needs to be done in front of him, so even if you're in the same province together, but you're not together, so then that's not going to work as well. Meaning, what is this division of Eretz Yisrael into three parts? It's either or, meaning this should be a binary discussion. Either a challenge does not have to be made in front of him, and it doesn't matter where you are, or a challenge does have to be made in front of him. And again, even if you're in the same province together, but if you're not living in the same town, so the challenge is unfounded. It doesn't have any legitimacy to it. So I'm Rabbi Abba Bar Mama Lolam Kesavra Machal Shlo Bafan of Havya Machal. So on that Mishnah, so Rabbi Abba Bar Mama teaches the following, that when you're challenging, so the challenge does not have to be done in front of him. Meaning, you could be somewhere else, not directly in front of the squatter, and you can and you could submit a formal challenge. That in fact would work. So umas nisin. So then, what's the Mishnah doing? Meaning, I don't understand the Mishnah. So b'shas chayrim shanu. The Mishnah is talking about where the times are a little bit chaotic, right? In modern Hebrew, chayrim is a state of emergency. Okay, so over here with shas chayrim. Okay, the times are a little bit chaotic. Umayshna Yehuda v'galo denaka destam Yehuda v'galo kishas chayrim dami. And generally speaking, the way to look at the dividing line between Yehuda and the Gala, and for that matter, you can add Avar Yardin as well. So it's like Shas Chayrim, meaning Shas Chayrim basically is a time in which, well, Shas Chayrim by itself is a time in which you can expect information not to get across because the times are a little bit more chaotic. Yehuda and Gala, even in the best of times, basically follow in that manner, in that pattern, in which information doesn't cross over from Yehuda to Gala and vice versa. And again, Avar Yarden, you could say the same thing. And so basically what we're learning together is the following. When you're lodging a challenge, what do you expect? In other words, how do you lodge a challenge when you're not in front of the squatter? So you do so in front of Adam, and you say that I am now formally challenging the squatter because I don't want him to own the land. 3 years going unchallenged, he's going to own the land. So I'm formally lodging a challenge. When you do so in front of Adam. It doesn't have to be in front of it, with the assumption that now that you've done so formally, the information is going to get back to the squatter. However, if it's Shas Chayrim, it's not going to get back to the squatter. And Yehuda and Galal is like Shas Chayrim. Okay, so what comes out from all this is that basically, assuming information is going to filter through, so then you can lodge a challenge even Shelo Bifanov. So basically where we're left is that if the claim and counterclaim is that I purchased land from you, and I've been successfully sitting on it now for 3 years, and that third year is a little bit fuzzy in terms of why there was no challenge in that third year. So the Gemara says, you know why the Mishnah didn't mention it? Because either way, either the case is going to be where he ran away because of his life, where there you do not acquire the property, meaning that third year now that went unchallenged is just simply not going to be a year towards your Shnei Chazakah. Alternatively, he ran away because of money. But if he did that, then he is expected to challenge, and therefore your claim is going to be successful. So that's why I didn't make it into the Mishnah.
When it comes to Yovel, and we had people that were running away from trying to claim the land in the 50th year, the Gemara says, a hefker, baby, hefker.
Right.
Why doesn't it apply here? Why do we care if he is in person or not?
Right. In other words, how are we buying and selling lands that are going to be seemingly indefinite, right?
That would also be a national thing, where it would be a same year for everybody.
Yep.
This is going to be thousands of individual interaction.
No, but his question is that, in other words, in Eretz Yisrael, it's an ancestral property. Right. An ancestral property, so it goes on in perpetuity. So I'm thinking, and it's not because I'm right, but I'm just thinking that when Yovel was no longer Noeg, so therefore lands were then sold in perpetuity. From Baisheni and post Baisheni, so Yovel no longer was in effect. And so presumably then, from that point going forward, lands can be sold in perpetuity. That's what I'm thinking, and I'm not sure if I'm right.
If
but
the squatters are there for not longer than the 3 years, why can't you just remove them? What's the approach? Why have to
put them? Again, I'm using the word squatter, but not in the... A squatter just simply means that he's living on that property, and nobody's challenging it. And again, his claim is that he purchased it. So I'm sorry if it's a little bit misleading when I'm calling him a squatter. I'm just giving him a name. But in other words, he's on the property.
I'm saying, but if it's your property,
when you say your property, what does that mean?
Either you have a deed.
Right. Right. Good.
It's an ancestral property.
Right. So in other words, good. So you have a deed. How long do you expect it to hold the deed on? So the assumption that they make is that no more than 3 years. After 3 years, there's no need to hold on to the deed. That's their assumption.
So you're saying he may not have the
actual correct
deed, and therefore you have to prove somehow, somewhere.
Correct. So the only thing you can do within those first 3 years is first of all, you can go to Beis Din and you can simply say, please get him off my property, right? And if he doesn't have a deed, kick him off. Alternatively, in other words, right now that you're unavailable, so you'll lodge a formal protest. That's what's called a macha. So as long as you do that, so it'll block his ability to make a successful claim to the property.
You can't just go
No, more than nicely, meaning if you're the owner of the property and he doesn't have a deed, so you'll throw him out. And if he's not listening, so you get Beis Din. And Beis Din will do so. We're talking about now a scenario where you haven't, for 3 years, you haven't said anything. Okay. V'lisnei, we are now on the top of Yud Ches Amud Aleph. V'lisnei, Mod Rav Yishua Bar Melacha Ver, Mana Levisi Mimcha Parisa Lecha. Okay, this is now going to be our third proposal of what the Mishnah could have done or should have done. And we're looking for cases in which there's a migul. And what the Gemara is really looking for is, why did the Mishnah go in a somewhat circuitous route where I'm confronting a person, I'm telling him that, look, this property was owned by your father. Okay. In other words, which again, that's the case in the Mishnah, and that's a good case. Isn't there like a more direct case? So the Gemara says, good. So, why not go over the case in which I say to my friend, "Mani levisi mimcha, I borrowed 100 from you, uparasi lecha, and I paid you back." Now, obviously, in this case over here, there's no documentation. Had there been documentation, the claims would just basically fall away. So there's no docs, there's no loan docs over here. And now shu neman. Now over here, that would seemingly be a wonderful case of a pesha aser or pesha iter, meaning I'm the one now who creates the problem by admitting that I owed you the money, but then extricate myself by telling you that I paid you. So mishum de kabbala misa seifa. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why that would not have been a good case in our Mishnah, meaning that in of itself, perfect. However, look at the next part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah then says, "Im yesh edim shulava mimenu v'hu amar parasisa parasiv eino neman." Ah, because the next part of the Mishnah is, what if the first part, meaning the liability part, was corroborated by witnesses or established by witnesses? So over here, let's plug that in over here in this case. Witnesses come and say that you borrowed the money. So now, is it true now that when you say, "I paid you," you're not going to be believed? It's not true. Why? Because here's the halacha. The halacha is that when you borrow money, even in front of witnesses, so it does not need to be paid back in front of witnesses. Now again, let's be clear. We're talking about a case where there is no loan doc. If there's a loan doc and the lender's holding on to the loan doc, you can make any claim you want that you paid it back. The fact that the lender is also a note holder, so at that point in time, you have no legs to stand on. Meaning that loan document is now screaming that you didn't pay back the loan. There is no loan document. It's an oral loan. However, it was done in front of Adim. So now, when you pay back, do you have to pay back in front of Adim? That's a machlokas, major machlokas. But the halacha is, ein tzarch lapar b'edim. You don't have to pay back with witnesses. Why that is, to be discussed on a different occasion. But that's the halacha. So the Gemara says, so even if witnesses said that you borrowed the money, you could still counter and say, "I paid it back." The halacha is, I don't have to pay back with witnesses. So now, why wasn't this case in the Mishnah? Because the second half simply is not true. When Adim say that you owe the money, so you could just simply still say, "Yeah, and I paid it back." The migul in that case would be, well, no. In other words, there are two parts of the Mishnah. In the first part of the Mishnah, there weren't Edim. Now you have a migul. And the second part, there are Edim. Therefore, there is no migul. So, but we're, and the Mishnah is just trying to show us that when you have a migul, you're believed. When there is no migul, you're not believed. It just happens to be in the case of a loan, even if there are witnesses, I'm still believed. That's why I didn't make it into the Mishnah.
Actually, it's a case of Pesha also.
In the second half, not necessarily, but still, it doesn't matter. In other words, it just doesn't conform to the format of the Mishnah. Yes. Now, v'lisnei mod Rav Yeshua ba'omer l'chaver amana l'avicha bi'adi ve'echaltiv pras shu neman. So the Gemara says, how about this? Okay, this is going to be our last attempt, and that's going to be the following. I say to a person, so I borrowed money from your father, and what I did is that I paid him back some of it. Right, chaltiv pras. Right, I fed him a portion of it, meaning I paid back some of the loan. Okay, this is what's called in halacha modeh b'mitzas. Now, but this is not a classic modeh b'mitzas. Modeh b'mitzas, classic goes like this. Right, someone comes over to me and says, "You owe me money. You owe me $100." And I say, "Nope, I only owe you 50, because the other 50 I paid back already." Okay, so that's a classic case of modeh b'mitzas. Over here, I'm going to a person and I'm saying, "I owed your father 100 and I paid him back 50. Now, why is this not a classic case of modeh b'mitzas? That's what we're going to be discussing now for the remaining section of this section. So Aliba the man, Aliba the Rabban and Hamri Meshav Aveda Have, Aliba the Rabbalaz Ben Yaakov Hamar Shvu Abaye. So the Gemara says, wait 1 second. If you subscribe to the Shita of the Chachamim, this is what's called Hashavas Aveda. You're returning a lost item. I'll explain that better in just a moment. If you subscribe to the Shita of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, you have to make a Shvua, meaning that your admission by itself is insufficient, but you're going to have to make a Shvua of Moda B'Mixas. Okay, now, Ditanya. We learned in the Brisa, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, Amar Pamim Shadam Nishba Al Tanis Atzmo, Ketza Man La'avicha Biyadi Ve'echelti Pras HaRei Zeh Nishba, Ve'zeh Shenishba Al Tanis Atzmo. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov is of the opinion that in this case that we're describing, so despite the fact that this is not a Moda B'Mixas classic, still, it's Moda B'Mixas. I'm telling you that I borrowed 100 from your father and I paid him back 50. You must make a Shvua. And the Chachamim say, call this a Shavas Aveda. You're returning a lost item. You don't have to make a Shvua when returning a lost item. So the Gemara says, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, Leisa Meshav Aveda Pater. Now wait 1 second. Hashavas Aveda. Do you ever have to make a Shvua on Shavas Aveda? The answer is no. Right? Categorically. Right? Period, end of sentence. When you're returning back a lost item. Okay, so Amarav. Now, before we go on to the Gemara. So let's just explain this a little bit better. Right? What do you mean, Hashavas Aveda? You don't have to make a Shvua. So this is based on the Gemara in Gittin, and quite frankly, our Gemara as well. And that is the following. Right? You lost your wallet. So, what do? I come back and I return your wallet to you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Wait. Hold it. Where are you going? Open up the wallet. You had two $100 bills in there, and right now there's only one $100 bill. Okay, I really appreciate you returning my wallet. But may I ask you a question? I had two $100 bills in there, and now currently there's only one. Can you? Do you have an explanation? What do you mean explanation? I found it. In other words, it was lost, and I found it, and I'm returning it to you. And now you want me to go to court and make a shvua? Like that's ridiculous. Now, it's not ridiculous, meaning the guy's making what seems to be a good point, meaning he did have two $100 bills in there. So, fundamentally, so is there a requirement of Moda B'Mixas? Sure. In other words, it is Moda B'Mixas. On the other hand, what have you just done? You've just disincentivized anyone from returning any lost object. Meaning, I find a lost object, and now what? And now I'm going to return it, and now I'm going to go to court for doing a good thing? Thank you, but no thank you. So what the Chachamim did is that they waived. In every case of Hashavas Aveda, they waived the Shvua requirement. Otherwise, no one's going to ever be incentivized to return anything. Good. So that's an institution, a takana, that there is no Shvua requirement when returning a lost item. So now, that's a given. In our case over here, meaning when you say that I borrowed money from your father and I paid him back 50, so is that something which is tantamount to Hashavas Aveda? At first glance, the answer, of course, is yes. Why? In other words, I understand I'm not returning a lost item, but in principle, it's pretty much the same thing. Because what basically I'm saying to him is that, look, I don't have to tell you anything. Meaning, at this point in time, any money I'm giving you right now is gravy. I borrowed money from your father. Did you know about it? He didn't even know about it. And now I'm telling you that I paid him back half, and I still owe half. So technically, I'm owed the B'Mixos, but at least in principle, it's a lot like Hashavas Aveda. So am I required to make a Shvua? So at face value, the answer would be no. In fact, that's the sheet of the Chachamim. This is a Hashavas Aveda type scenario.
Because it's a third party, it's not really...
Correct. And Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is saying no. In this case over, you still also have to make a Shvua. So now, the Gemara says like this. So, V'amar Mari Nishban, I'm sorry. So, the Rav Elazar ben Yaakov leisay meshav aveda pater. I'm sorry. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov leisay meshav aveda pater. Let me inflect correctly. So now the Gemara wants to know, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, like, how is this not a case of Hashavas Aveda? Meaning, again, it's not precisely Hashavas Aveda, but it's tantamount to Hashavas Aveda. You're giving him information that he didn't even know. And because technically you're admitting to still owing part of the obligation, that's considered a mode that makes us, yeah, but you didn't have to tell him anything. So Amarav b'Torano Katan. So the Gemara says no. In other words, what happened over here is a claim was made against you by the son. The son's the child. So the Gemara says V'Amar Mari Nishbal Natanis Chereshot VeKatan. Okay, if he's a child, so then his claim is not a registered claim. It's not a legal claim, right? Children cannot advance claims in court. It's a basic rule. Anyone who does not have das does not have the ability to make a claim. So my katan, so gadol. So the Gemara says, okay, so it was a child, but not a child, meaning it was the son of, but he was an adult. So the Gemara says, v'amai karele katan d'lagabi miladaviv katan hu. Now, the reason why he's called a katan in this particular scenario is because, right, he's a katan in the sense of, he doesn't know what his father's dealings are. He didn't know who his father lent money to. Now, ihachi tanis atzmo tanis achirim hi. So the Gemara says, okay, so the way that Rav Elazar ben Yaakov describes it, go back to the Braisa, right, just above the midpoint of the Amud, and you'll see Rav Elazar ben Yaakov describes it as tanis atzmo, that the claim is a self-reporting. Self-reporting, it's not. Meaning now our understanding is that the son of the lender is the one bringing you to court. He made a claim against you. So tanis achirim v'odas atzmo. So the Gemara says, okay, good. So good. So now let's clarify. Meaning you're right. The son made a claim against you, and you admit it. So the Gemara says, okay, do you know what we call that? We call that mode b'mitzas. So kulu tanaisa tanis achirim v'odas atzmo ninu. Yeah, congratulations. That's every mode b'mitzas. So ela hacha b'derava kemiflagi. So the Gemara says like this. Okay, so what's the difference between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim? Again, the case is where the son of the lender comes over to me and says, right, I think you owe me money, meaning my dad lent you money, and I don't remember him ever telling me that you paid. I think you owe us money, right? In other words, if the loan's outstanding, so you are obligated to pay. Now, the father's no longer alive, so you pay the estate. Right now, he's representing the estate. So good, so he's got a good claim. But again, it's a good claim, but he doesn't really know. Obviously, there's no docs. There's no loan doc. So now, what do you come back? You come back and you say, okay, so you know what? I hear the claim. And I paid half already. And I owe the remainder. So now, is this a case of moda b'mixas? So this is now the debate between the Chacham and Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov says it is moda b'mixas. And the Chachamim says no. It's more like Hashavas Aveda. Which means, again, Hashavas Aveda is now, technically it's moda b'mixas, but you're waived. Because you could have just simply said, I owe nothing. And by virtue of the fact that you're at least admitting to owing something, it's like Hashavas Aveda. Now what the Gemara wants to do is understand what's the machlokus between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim. Gemara goes on to explain. It comes down to a little bit of psychology. So the Amar Rabba, so Ella, Hacha b'derabba kemifli, the Amar Rabba, Mimneima Amar Torah, Moda b'mikza satani shava. So why is it that the Torah requires you to make a shvu by Moda b'mikzas? Meaning Rabba gives a somewhat psychological explanation in terms of the thought processes that goes behind somebody who makes a partial admission. If somebody lent you money, so you're not going to be chutzpah dick enough to deny the entire claim. Okay. Now, you're probably thinking, I don't know. People can have that level of chutzpah. Okay, fine. So I understand that the starting point of this discussion can be questioned and deliberated, but the Gemara is making underlying assumptions. Obviously, we're going to work with those assumptions. So the assumption is that if you really owe somebody money and you're not going to just simply look at him directly in the face and say, I owe you nothing. Okay, you will not be that brazen. So, Ba'achovo. But right now, you simply don't have the money to pay him back. So you're not going to go, you're not going to say zero. And okay, Gemara sounds a little bit repetitive, but anyway, you're not going to be that chutzpedek. Okay, good. So if you're not going to deny it, so then obviously you're going to want to admit to it. Problem is, So what I'm really trying to do right now is just simply buy time. So I'm looking to buy time. I'm not going to deny the whole thing. I got the solution. So I do have some money. So what I'll tell him is that I owe you some money. And that'll buy me time. In other words, again, everyone thinks of themselves as a good person. I'm fundamentally a good person. I am lying right now, but it's not a terrible lie. I'm not denying the whole thing. I'm admitting to part of it. And when I get the balance, then I'm going to go pay. That's the thought process as explained by Rabba of the halach of moda b'mikzas, right? It's so funny. Alan, you asked me earlier this morning, right? What's behind the Torah in terms of almana versus grusha? And I mentioned the Gemara doesn't discuss it. Here, we're going to hear this five times throughout Shas, meaning this is a Gemara that gets repeated often, in terms of what's the thought process of the Torah and why there's a Shvu of Moed B'Mitzvos. Okay, so, right, most of... Oh, okay, good. Perfect, perfect.
You can't lie to the guy who lent
you money. Perfect. So well said, and that's exactly what the Gemara is going to say. Perfect. So now, this is going to be a case where the Gemara itself gives us a reason behind the halacha. Okay, so now, and now, what is Moed B'Mitzvos now forcing you to do? Admit the whole loan. Good. Because, again, people are scared when making a shvua. Good. So that is all behind the mechanics behind, the psychological mechanics behind making a shvu of Moed B'Mitzvos. And Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov sar v'lo shnabo v'lo shnabo v'no eino me'iz v'hilkach lav meshev avedave. So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is of the position that now this idea that you won't be me'iz, that's the starting point, so that would be true whether you're speaking directly to the lender or the son of the lender. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says it won't change the dynamics. And Rabbanan Savri Bo, who Deino Meiz, Vabibno Meiz, Umidelo Heiz, Meshav Aveda Havei. And the Chachamim will disagree with that starting point, meaning that the dynamics now have changed. To the lender himself, who quite frankly helped me out when I needed him and lent me money. So to him, I will not have the chutzpah to simply say, I owe you nothing. But once now I'm no longer looking at the face of the lender. No, I know it's the son of the lender, but still, it's not him directly. So now, you know what? I'm gonna get a little more courage, and I'm not saying that as a positive, but now I'm with a little bit. Sorry. Now with a little bit more courage, I'm gonna look at him directly and say, "I owe you nothing." So that now changes the dynamics, and now that you whatever you admit, that's gravy. It's hashavas aveda. That's what the Chachamim will say. And that's the debate between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim. But to make a long story shorter, that it didn't fit into our Mishnah simply because it doesn't fit into our Mishnah. Meaning we're trying to understand why Rav Yeshua gave one specific case and not this case. Meaning we went through three different cases. Yesterday we went through a fourth, but we went through three different cases of why the Mishnah didn't give this case. It didn't give this case, meaning I owed your father money, but I paid him back some of it. It didn't give this case because it depends who you hold like. If I'm holding like the Chachamim, so at that point in time, you're believed. You don't have to make a Shavua. And if you're holding like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, you're not believed and you have to make a Shavua. Okay. And the case, the Halacha falls like the Chachamim. Yeah, it's funny because normally Mishnah is Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Kavanaki, right? That's what you're thinking, right? Which is true, but over here he's going against the Chachamim. He's a Shitas Yachid. Okay, let's start. Okay, we're going to start the next Mishnah and the upcoming Gemara. It will require an introduction, so you're going to hear, God willing, you're going to hear the introduction twice this morning and tomorrow morning. But let's go over some basics. Okay, you have a document. The document allows you to go ahead and collect the money. Now, what is a document? So a document, we're just talking about a loan doc. Obviously, there's so many different types of documents we could talk about. But in talking about a shtar, so how does a shtar work? It's so funny, right? You would think that the shtar needs to be signed by the borrower, by the lender. Okay, no. The shtar is just simply proof that a loan occurred. So the shtar is going to obviously... name the lender and the borrower, and obviously it's going to have the loan amount, and it's going to have the date in which the origination of the loan. And then what's going to happen? Two witnesses are going to sign. Obviously, the two witnesses who witnessed the loan. So, what is the strength of a shtar? It's the fact that you have Adim signing on the shtar. Okay. Now, Adim signing on a shtar. So, is that Adis? Is that testimony? That's a funny question. And with a not a straightforward answer. Meaning that, normally speaking, in halacha, how does edus work? You come to court. You testify. So over here, they signed on a document. So is that considered like testimony? So what you're going to be hearing today, and a number of times throughout Shas, is that it's going to be treated like testimony. The Rambam happens to be of a very interesting opinion that is that this is a rabbinic institution. Right, shtaros operate midrabanan. Okay, I tell you the truth. As interesting as it is, the Rambam writes that, I'm not sure how, if any way it's going to affect or impact the halacha. In other words, two witnesses signing on a document, and now the document is as if they're submitting testimony in court, so it works. Meaning every time you produce a document, so it's going to work. In other words, it will allow you to go ahead and collect the money. Good. So you have two witnesses signing on a document, and now the document is locked and loaded. So now that you are holding that document, you're holding the note, so that's going to entitle you to collect the money. So far, so good. Really straightforward. Now, is it possible that you can have two witnesses forge a signature on any given document? Of course. So there is going to be a verification process. It's called Kiyum Shtaros. Okay, now, like any system, this is going to be an imperfect system, and the Kiyum itself can also be forged if necessary, if there's a really strong desire to do so. There's no system that's going to create a foolproof, rock-solid method of ensuring that there's no foul play going in order. All it is just simply another layer to try to prevent fraud. Okay, it's like the world in which we live in right now. To the best of our ability, we're trying to prevent fraud, and unfortunately, it happens all the time. So this is going to be just simply another step. This step is called Kiyum Shtaros. Okay, and now for a good part of this second parak, we are going to be discussing Kiyum Shtaros. The idea is very simple. Just in terms of the practicalities of it and the details of it, it gets a little bit detailed. And it's going to get a little bit complicated. But the idea in general is very simple. And that is, let's verify the signatures. Meaning I have two signatures assigned on this document. So we're going to have a verification process. How is the verification process going to be done? It can be done in one of three ways. I'm just saying all this by way of intro. Number one, those who signed on the document actually come to court and say, that's our signatures. Good. And what the courts then is going to do is that they're going to put a little note saying that this was verified in front of us. Good. That's one. Two, other witnesses go ahead and report that they recognize those signatures. Okay. So for those of you who are employed, right, I happen to be one of those people. So Baruch Hashem, gainfully employed. So I recognize the signatures of the people who signed my checks. So now, if there was another occasion in which I saw the signature in another document, again, could it be forged? Of course it could. But the signatures, generally speaking, are stylistic, and usually they're identifiable. And so therefore, I will be believed, but not me by myself. I need another witness, but the two of us will be believed when we go ahead and attest to that signature. That's number two. Number three, let's say we already have other already certified documents with these signatures on it. And what you can do now is you can just simply compare. In other words, I have another document with already a certified signature on it, and now I'm looking at this signature, so compare. If it's a match, we're good to go. Those are three different ways in which it could be Mekayim Ashtar.
Why can't two witnesses say that they saw them sign it?
Okay, good.
It's not itemized, but...
Fine. That basically will fall into category number one. Right? That's what they're right. I'm sorry. That's not number one. That'll be number two. Okay, fine. Yeah. Okay, good. Good. So this is a parsha known as Kiyum Shtaros, the parsha. Meaning there's no parsha in the Torah about this, but this is the idea behind Kiyum Shtaros. And again, like I said, a lot of details. So, but I am just, this is just a broad overview of the topic. Edom Shamar B'Ksav Yadenu Huzeh, Ava Anusim Ayinu Ketana Ayinu P'Sile Eidos Ayinu, Hare Elu Ne'emanim. Witnesses come, and they say "Ksav Yadenu," meaning, "Yeah, this is our handwriting." All right, you're correct. However, let's also provide a little bit more information, and that is, we were forced, we were minors, we were disqualified. So ne'emanim, they're going to be believed. Okay, so this is going to be now an example in which they are, on one hand, creating now over here, I would say a liability. Now, it's interesting. When I say creating a liability, not for themselves. In other words, they're basically now verifying that the document is a good document. Meaning, was it signed by witnesses? Sure. The witnesses are coming and telling us right now that they're the ones who signed it. Oh, but wait. They have more to say. So since now they're believed on the first part of their statement, they're now going to believe on the second part of the statement. Now, the second part of the statement is like, but wait a second. Here's the rest of the story. at the time where we signed it, we had no business signing it. We were minors. We were disqualified. We were forced to sign it. Okay, gun to our head. Okay? So this is now going to be a circumstance in which HaPesha Asur or HaPesha Iter. Okay? And again, why are we learning about this in Ksuvos? This seemingly has nothing to do with Ksuvos. You're right. But once we got onto the topic of HaPesha Asur or HaPesha Iter, so therefore it made it into the Mishnayos. However, if their signatures were being verified externally by other witnesses, at that point in time, now we don't believe them. Meaning now, what do they want to say? Yes, we signed it, but, well, at this point in time, no. In other words, because they're not the ones who are validating, verifying the signature, therefore we don't believe them on the rest of their story. Good. So this is a straightforward example of HaPesha Asur HaPesha Iter. We're going to do a little bit of Gemara this morning. Amar Ami Bechama Loshana Loshamar Anusim Hayinu Machmas Mamon. The Mishnah, now there are two parts of the Mishnah. The part in which they're believed and the part where they're not believed. Right now we're assuming that Rami Bechama is going on the second part of the Mishnah. On the part where they're not believed. When are they not believed? That's when only they say Machmas Mamon. We were forced, but we were forced, not compelled with our lives, but compelled with money. So, however, if, let's say, the signatures were externally verified, and they come in and they say, yeah, but we were held at gunpoint. So then they're going to be believed. So Rava says, I don't see that. I totally disagree. Meaning, when they're signing on the document, so that is tantamount to testimony. What do we know regarding testimony? Here's a basic halacha. Once you submit testimony, you cannot recant. Okay? In this great country that we live in, testimony can be recanted. Good. Halacha does not work that way. Halacha is that once you submit testimony into court, you cannot recant it. Even if you have a wonderful explanation of why you're recanting your testimony, cannot do it. Okay, good. So that's the halacha. And the same thing is regarding signatures. Because again, signatures are going to be treated like testimony. And so therefore, once they sign, and so they cannot recant on that testimony. Maybe you want to tell me a difference. There's a difference between oral testimony and in this case, written testimony. Reish Lakish gives us a fundamental rule. And that is, do you know how we look at signatures who sign on a document? We look at that as if they're testifying in court, right? I know I said this during the intro. This is it. This is the line of the Gemara that basically tells us that witnesses on a document are like they gave testimony in court. So, Elaki Edmar, Resha Edmar. So the Gemara says, okay, so Rami Bar Chama was trying to teach us something, but it wasn't going on the Seif of the Mishnah. In the Seif of the Mishnah, once the witness is signed on the document and it's verified externally, so now, even if the witnesses themselves say, but wait, let me give you some more context. At that point in time, they can't do it. Because again, what they're trying to do now is recant on their testimony, and no can do. You cannot recant on testimony. So, what Rami Bar Chama was teaching us was not on the Seif of the Mishnah, but the Reisha of the Mishnah. So, Ella ki itmar Reisha itmar hare elu ne'manim. So in the Reish of the Mishnah, they're telling us that they're Neman. So Amar Amim Bercham Loshanu Loshamru Anusim Haynu Machmas Tefashos. So when are they going to be believed? So witnesses are coming into the court. How do we know that these signatures are theirs? There's no external verification. They themselves are verifying. Okay, now they themselves are verifying, but they got more to tell us. So now because they're creating the verification, we're going to listen to them. However, Rami Berchama says, we'll listen to them if they tell us that they signed it under duress over the threat of losing their life. Aval amaranusim haynu machmas mamon, ein emanim. But let's say they come into court and they say, look, we signed it, that's true. And we'd like to explain to you why we signed it, because we got bribed. Rami Bar Chama says, if that's what they're saying, we don't believe them. So my taima, ein adam esim asas marasha, because now what are they doing? Basically, they're saying that they got bribed, so you cannot incriminate yourself. Well, very interesting. Meaning, when the halacha says you cannot incriminate yourself, once again, let's make a really clear distinction between what we're used to in this country and the halacha of Ein Adam Eisa Matzma Rasha. In this country, you have the right to remain silent, but everyone knows the rest. Anything you say can and will be held against you in a court of law. Amazing, by the way. Baruch Hashem. Never read to me, but, you know. unfortunately, I've seen enough movies. So, we all know it. So anyway, but the halacha is a halacha. In American law, so you can incriminate yourself. You just simply don't. You don't have to. You do have the right to remain silent. In halacha, it's not that. In halacha, so Ein Adam Eisa Matzma Rasha, you can't incriminate yourself. Meaning, even if you'd like to say horrible things about yourself, it is not submitted in court. It is not registered. Beis Din does halachically does not hear it. They just simply cannot hear it. And so therefore, even though you're saying, we got bribed, okay, wonderful. In other words, Beis Din basically now hits the mute button. In other words, you're trying to incriminate yourself, you can't do it. So all they're hearing right now is you saying, we signed on it. That's all they're hearing. And so therefore, under those circumstances, if they're now explaining that they were bribed and they accepted a bribe, we don't believe them. We don't believe them because we can't believe them because we can't hear them on that. That's what's called self-incrimination. And in halacha, in adam eisa matzas marasha. Okay. So as Rami Bar Chama says, the only case of the Mishnah in which there is going to be a scenario, pesha asar or pesha iter, is only when their explanation was, is that we signed it under the threat of our lives. That's not a rasha, meaning if someone's threatening you with your life, so you lie. In other words, you'll sign a document. Okay. And, right? You only give up your life for three halachas. Outside of that, you don't give up your life. Now, that's an oversimplification, and there are going to be other circumstances where you do give up your life, but this is a case where the right thing to do is to sign on it. You don't have to give up your life for that. Okay, so that's not Ein Adam Eisa Matzma Rasha, and therefore you're going to be believed if that's your explanation. Okay, let's quickly recap our daf today. Oh, very good. What did we do today? So number one, a continuation of yesterday, the cases that the Mishnah didn't give. Meaning Rabbi Yoshua says, I'm going to give you this case of Migu. The case in the Mishnah is, the land belonged to your father. I purchased it from him. That's the case in the Mishnah where, since you didn't have to say anything, and now you forwarded the information that indicted yourself, you can also give the information that will extricate yourself from that. HaPesha Asr Hu HaPesha Iter. That's the case in the Mishnah. What are the cases the Mishnah did not offer as a case? So between yesterday's daf and today's daf, four other cases that the Mishnah didn't give. Why didn't it give that case? So that was really the first part of today's daf, taking us all the way to the Mishnah. And then once we got to the Mishnah, Yud Chesam and Beis, so now we're moving into the topic of Kiyum Shtaros, but another case of Shasru HaPesha Iter, where the witnesses are coming forward and they're verifying their own signature. They verify their own signature, but with an explanation of, but let me just tell you that we've signed it under duress. They're going to be believed. Why? HaPesha Asru HaPesha Iter. Ah, but in the case where we have already externally verified the signatures, at that point in time, now they're coming forward and telling us something bad about their signatures, or it's no good, we don't believe them at that point in time, because we don't need their testimony right now. In other words, we already verified it externally. Okay. And then what we learned today is the Halacha Rami Bar Chama. And that is that even when, in the first case of the Mishnah, when they're going to be believed, talui depends. If what they're coming and saying is that we signed it under duress for fear of our lives, fine. That's a fair explanation. That's legitimate. But if they're telling us that they got bribed, they're not going to be believed. Why? Because of the principle of Ein Adam Mesim Es Atzma Rasha.